You'll see that we have a special topic today as we're thinking about Muhammad and Jesus and what is the difference and whether it matters. And we're very pleased to have Robert Scott with us. And Robert Scott says here on this book, which is available to buy if you want to buy it at the back. It says here, Robert Scott oversees the international outreach at St. Helens Bishopsgate, where he runs meetings for better understanding with Muslim and Christian partners. He previously worked in Bangladesh and with the World Health Organization. So we think he's very well qualified to help us to answer this question, which he's done a lot of thinking about. And you'll see that there's a handout which you all hopefully received when you came in, which will help you later. Without any further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Rob. Before that, I'm going to pray a short prayer as we get started. Heavenly Father, we thank you and praise you for this chance to think about this topic together, and we pray that you would help us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, thank you for your welcome, Philip, and it's good to be with you this lunchtime. As Philip said, you've got this handout. It's probably more extensive than you're used to here at lunchtime, but that's partly because I want to get as many references down there as possible so you can check what I'm saying, that I'm not making it up and hopefully not taking stuff out of context. And it will help you to follow along with what I'm saying. So Muhammad and Jesus, what's the difference and does it matter? At the top there, you've got a couple of cheesy posters taken off the internet. Keep calm and love Muhammad. The SAW after Muhammad is the Arabic phrase for peace and blessings be upon him. And Christians, not to be outdone, say keep calm and love Jesus more. This time together is not supposed to be an exercise in one-upmanship, in playground religion, in competitive religious syndrome. My God is better than your God. My dad is bigger than your dad. We're not trying to do that, so please don't think that. Another danger, though, I think we can get in to is not to talk about these things at all, to censor ourselves for fear of upsetting or offending people. Now, it is right not to upset people on purpose or offend people on purpose, but to not talk about important things, whether it's religious or otherwise, is not a good thing. We should be people of truth. We should be prepared to speak about truthful things, but to do so in a loving way. And that's what I hope to be doing. Now, some of you might think, well, Jesus and Muhammad, they're just the same. Just the same in peace, maybe. That the Muslim greeting, Assalamu alaikum, peace be with you. Those were some of the first words that Jesus gave on that first Easter Sunday to his companions, his disciples. When he appeared to them, he said, my peace be with you. So maybe these two characters are just the same. They talk about peace. Or maybe you think, that's rubbish. It's a peaceful veneer over a violent religion that both promote it. Whether it's ISIS or the Crusades, treatment of women or treatment of children, they're both violent, so the same in that way. Or maybe you just think, this is utterly irrelevant. With Brexit or not coming up, that's far more important, far more relevant. With austerity, benefit cuts, that's far more relevant than some person claiming to be a prophet. Well, I hope by the end of this afternoon that we will see there is relevance here. There are some similarities. Both claim to be prophets. Both talk about a holy book. Both talk about God. Both talk about heaven and hell. But there are some important differences between them. One Jewish rabbi has said that it's in differences that we find knowledge. It's in contrasts that we find wisdom. And there are real differences and real contrasts between these two characters. And through that we gain knowledge and wisdom. And I would say that this is relevant now. It helps us to live in this world, in the workplace, in Britain and wherever else, when we rightly understand these people. But it's also relevant forever. Both men claim something about beyond death. Are they right? If they are, then what we say today and think about does have relevance beyond here and now. So what do you think about Muhammad? Islam is a religion followed by 1.4 billion people across the world. To summarise that in the 10 minutes I'm giving to Muhammad is not nearly enough. It's inevitably brief. I've inevitably been selective. But I put my selections down here and the references that you can look them up later to show where I've got them from, to hopefully see that I haven't taken things out of context. And all the time I've used Muslim sources, not people against Islam in any way. The only non-Muslim source I've had here is very promoting of Muhammad. So the first quote here, then, on who is Muhammad. According to Islamic belief, the Prophet Muhammad was the last messenger of God. He, like all of God's prophets and messengers, such as Noah, Abraham, Moses and Jesus, was only a human being. Christians came to the mistaken assumption that Muslims worship Muhammad by formulating an incorrect analogy. They worship Jesus, so they assumed Muslims worship Muhammad. This is one of the reasons they called Muslims by the incorrect name Muhammadans for so many years. And many years, in fact, people have called Muslims Muhammadans. I've got a book on my bookshelf at home by a professor of Islamic studies in Oxford, written in 1965, so not that long ago, and it's entitled Muhammadanism, followers of Muhammad. But this quote is saying that's wrong. Just because Christians are called Christians because they worship Christ, don't call us Muslims Muhammadans. We don't worship Muhammad in that way. And why is that? Well, you've got a quote at the bottom there. Narrated Umar. And Umar was the second caliph after Muhammad. The first was Abu Bakr, and this is the second leader of the Muslim community. And he said this: I heard the Prophet Muhammad saying, do not exaggerate in praising me as the Christians praise the Son of Mary, for I am only a slave. So call me the slave of Allah and his apostle. Now, the term slave of Allah is quite a common Muslim name. It's Abdullah, slave of Allah. And Umar is saying, I heard Muhammad say this, that I'm just a slave, no more than that. And that quote comes from Sahih Bukhari. Sahih means sound or authentic. And Bukhari is a man who collected sayings about Muhammad about 150 years after Muhammad. He talked to people who had talked to people who had talked to people who'd known Muhammad. And much of that went into this. This is a summarised version here that I bought in Bangladesh, but it's in English so I can understand it. And in most Islamic bookshops you'll find something like this, or the whole nine volumes. There's a lot of resources about what Muhammad is said to have said and did. So that's one quote from you there. Don't exaggerate. On the top of page two, from the first caliph, the first leader of the Muslim people after Muhammad, Muhammad has died, and he says this: whoever amongst you worships Muhammad, or Muhammad is dead. But whoever worships Allah, Allah is alive and will never die. Allah said, Muhammad is no more than a messenger. Many were the messengers that passed away before him. That bit Allah said is taken from the Quran, Surah 3. So Abu Bakr is again saying, don't worship Muhammad, he's dead. Worship Allah, he is alive. The Quran tells us that. And then one quote from the Quran below that, from Surah 18. Muhammad is told to say to the people, say, I am but a man like yourselves. But the inspiration has come to me that your Allah is one Allah. Whoever expects to meet his Lord, let him work righteousness. And in the worship of his Lord, admit no one as partner. So Muhammad is told to say by Allah in the Quran, I am just a man like you. But there is a difference. I have received revelation from God. I've received the Quran, this inspiration, that specifically tells us there is one God, one Allah alone. And you mustn't admit any partners to him. None of this Trinity nonsense, my Muslim friends tell me. But you notice too that Muhammad is told to say, let him work righteousness in that quote. And that's at the heart of Islam. For people who want to get to paradise, you must work righteousness. You must do good things in order to hopefully receive God's mercy, Allah's mercy, on the last day. So we see that Muhammad here, from Muslim quotes, from the Quran, from his closest companions, he's a man and only a man. But often when I talk to my Muslim friends, actually, Muhammad is much bigger than that. And here are some quotes again that I think help to show that. So again, from Sahih Bukhari, you have this quote: none will have faith until he loves Muhammad more than his family and all humanity. So Muhammad is supposed to be in the Muslim's heart more deeply than your mother. That's quite a strong love, isn't it? And then if you obey Muhammad, then you are obeying Allah. And if you disobey him, then you are disobeying Allah. So what Allah said and what Muhammad said is like that. You can't get a tissue paper between them. It's not saying Muhammad is God, but it's quite close to saying that kind of thing. And then Muhammad is raised up as the best example. If you ever not know how to practice your faith properly, look at Muhammad. He does it properly. Follow him. The Quran tells him to do that in Surah 33 and Surah 68. And then this next quote, it is often used by Islamic societies in universities around London when they have an Islam Awareness Week. It's from a Westerner saying how great Muhammad is. He's the best example. Philosopher, orator, apostle, legislator, warrior, conqueror of ideas, restorer of rational dogmas, of a cult without images, the founder of 20 terrestrial empires and one spiritual empire. That is Muhammad. As regards all standards by which human greatness may be measured, we may ask, is there any greater man than he? Muhammad here is raised up to be similar to Alexander the Great, or maybe Napoleon, or Churchill, in their power and authority across many lands. But more than that, he's got spiritual authority. He's created a spiritual dominion empire. So taking all that on board, we can understand then why cartoons about this man might be offensive to Muslim people. He's supposed to be closer in their hearts than their mothers. He's the greatest man that ever lived. We get upset if our mums are cussed in playground speech. Well, think how much more if this man is to be greater than your mum, if he gets cussed, how you would react to that. But there are problems with Muhammad too. In the Muslim sources, this particular book, The Life of Muhammad, written again about 150, 200 years after Muhammad, the earliest account of him by Ibn Hishaq, it says that he is unsure that he was hearing from God. Earlier we saw in Surah 18 that it says he received inspiration, but Muhammad, when he first receives it, is unsure. He doesn't know if he's going mad. He doesn't know if he's having a seizure. He doesn't know if maybe there's some demon being involved. He's unsure about what's really happening to him. He admits to not knowing where he is going, and yet he is to be the example to be followed. Surah 46 verse 9 says, I don't know what will happen to me. I don't know where I'm going. So why should he be the example to follow? Top of page 3. The Quran is very clear that Muhammad did no miracles. You don't have examples of him feeding the 5,000, for example. The Quran is said to be his miracle, but nothing more than that. It's clear too that Muhammad sinned. He got stuff wrong. One of the hadith, one of the sayings of Muhammad, is he said, one day I asked for forgiveness 70 times in a day. He did things that were wrong, that weren't pure or holy all the time. And then very sadly, as again this book makes out, he approved when mockers were killed. So there was a lady poet, and poetry in Muhammad's day was kind of the cartoons of the day. You'd write poems for and against people, or speak them rather than write them. And one lady was speaking a poem against Muhammad, not thinking that he was a prophet. And he asked one of his companions to kill her. And they did, and he approved of that. And that's in this book. It's not Western Orientalists making it up in some way. Now, it's not a short step from there to Charlie Hebdo. There's lots of things in between. There's Western colonial policy. There's borders drawn in deserts, bizarrely, by colonial powers. There's oil. There's poverty. There's inequality. There's hypocrisy in foreign policy. There's all of that going on as well. But it is a logical step to Charlie Hebdo. And the Charlie Hebdo killers were quoting things like that to justify their actions. This book and others are very clear too that Muhammad was involved in between 20 and 100 different skirmishes or battles. One good Muslim friend of mine, he teaches in a madrasa in Bethnal Green, and he puts the figure at 27 battles, he thinks, that Muhammad fought. I've given you a Wikipedia link there, not because I trust Wikipedia, but it gives you lots of examples and references to follow up on those battles if you want. But the Quran in Surah 9, verse 5, says, when the sacred months are over, slay the unbelievers wherever you find them. That the hadith interpretation of that here says that is how, one of the ways in which you promote Islam is through that fighting, through that killing. Again, in this book, you have an example where a Jewish tribe had joined with Muhammad around Medina to fight some people from Mecca. The Jewish tribe, though, switches sides and joins with the Meccans. But Muhammad and his army wins. The Jewish tribe is conquered, and Muhammad says, what do you think I should do to you? And they say, well, you should execute us. Now, I'm not sure how one would actually, whether one would say that, but that's in the Islamic record. And so what does Muhammad and his army do? They dig a trench and they behead between 600 and 900 Jewish men. Again, that's not a short step from there to what ISIS are doing. There's lots of things in between, lots of things that we here have some level of blame in terms of foreign policy and that kind of thing. But it's not an illogical step. I bought this book in an Islamic bookshop. The Islamic Conquest of Syria. I thought it was about ISIS, but it's about the first conquest of Syria in the 8th century. And what we see ISIS doing is exactly what Muhammad's companions did after his death in Syria. And you would have thought that his companions were the best interpreters of Islam in some way. Now, am I saying that all Muslim people are like this? No, not at all. My friend in the madrasa says that we shouldn't kill people, which I like. He is my friend. We get on very well. But he can't tell me why it doesn't apply today. Again, we're not saying that we should all join Britain First. They are an appalling organisation. They're often demonstrating outside East London Mosque, pitifully. We shouldn't join them and say all Muslims out. No, God puts people where he wants them. He determines the times and places they live. It's great that people are here from all different backgrounds. But we should be willing to speak truth and look up these things together and share them, which is what I've been doing with my madrasa friend as we look at these things together. And that's important for real relationships, truthful relationships that go beyond tolerance and respect and talk about true things in a loving way. That is relevant today. What do you think of Jesus? Well, Luke's Gospel, the first 8 chapters talk about Jesus as being born of a virgin, that he is proclaimed by angels, that he resisted temptation. He never once sinned. He was pure and holy. He proclaimed good news of freedom. He brought forgiveness. He was authenticated by miracles. Now, interestingly, all those things would be agreed by my Muslim friends. It comes from Luke chapters 1 to 8, but that's often in the Quran as well, that Jesus did those things. But what they would disagree with was what comes next in chapter 9. In chapter 9 of Luke, the issue is, who is this Jesus? He's given authority to his disciples to go and do some healing. And King Herod hears about it and says, look, what's going on here? Who is this guy? Some people said it's John the Baptist who's come back from the dead. He says, no, it's not him. Others say maybe it's Prophet Elijah come back from the dead. Or maybe it's prophet like Moses. So in this context of Luke chapter 9, who is Jesus? Is he one of the prophets from before or somebody else? And we see that Jesus is the Messiah or the Christ. I'll read this. Now it happens that as Jesus was praying alone, the disciples were with him. And he asked them, who do the crowds say that I am? And they answered, John the Baptist. But others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen. Then he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered, the Christ of God. Now Christ is the Greek word for Messiah, which is a word that means anointed one, someone who is anointed. And in the Old Testament, the first prophets looked forward to one being anointed who would rule forever, a king. And so Jesus is saying, I am that long-promised king. King David was told about this in 2 Samuel 7. He wrote a song about this in Psalm 2 and said, we must kiss, respect, turn to this anointed one and seek refuge in him because he is the king over all things. The prophet Isaiah talks about this king being God himself in those famous Christian Christmas readings. unto us a child is born. He will be called Mighty God. So Jesus is saying, I am that long promised king. But then he goes on and says that he's the Son of Man who dies and rises again. And he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. Son of Man there is a title given in a vision that Daniel, the prophet, receives. He sees one like a Son of Man being given authority over all the world for all time. And Jesus is saying, I'm that one. Daniel later on in a vision is told that this anointed one will be cut off, bringing forgiveness to others. The prophet Isaiah echoes those words in chapter 53 of Isaiah, where we're told that one is cut off for sins not his own. He takes the burden of others. He takes the sins of others so they might be forgiven, so they might receive life. So again, Jesus is saying, as Son of Man who will die and rise again, I am this promised global ruler who will bring forgiveness for all the things that we've ever done wrong, which is glorious news. And then he goes on, back to page 4. We see that Jesus is God's Son, his chosen one. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. Maybe a mountain a bit like Mount Sinai, where Moses got the Ten Commandments, or Mount Carmel, where Elijah had a kind of prophetic duel with the priests of Baal, the idol. And those two people appear here. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered, and his clothing became dazzling white. Maybe the kind of blazing white in the vision that Isaiah had in Isaiah chapter 6, where he sees something of God's throne room. Well, that's being echoed here. And behold, two men were talking with Jesus, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem, meaning his death and resurrection. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep. But when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it's good we're here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, not knowing what he was saying. And as he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them. The same kind of a cloud that appeared at Mount Sinai, showing God's presence, that came down onto the tabernacle in the desert and the temple in Jerusalem. And they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, This is my Son, my chosen one, listen to him. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they'd seen. Just from this short passage then, we see that Jesus is greater than Moses and Elijah. Moses brought the law. Elijah enforced the law against people who are following the idol of Baal. They disappear off this mountain and only Jesus is left. He is greater than they are. As you read the Quran, it's often the case that whenever Moses is mentioned, Muhammad is compared with him. He's trying to be a bit like Moses in bringing a law. And then Muhammad's actions in Mecca to destroy idols is a lot like Elijah. But Jesus is greater than Moses and Elijah, and therefore Muhammad, who tries to emulate both Moses and Elijah. We see here that Jesus is God's Son, and he knows where he's going. He knows he's going to Jerusalem to die and rise again, to bring life to others. And he's God's Son, and so he can talk about God much more fully than any prophet can do. He knows God much more intimately because he is God, his very Son. And yet Muhammad, within the Quran, cuts out those two things. It denies that Jesus is the Son and so can't fully reveal God to us. And it denies that he died and rose again and so cuts out the forgiveness that we can have through him. We have a truncated Jesus and no good news to proclaim if we go down that route. But God's verdict is, he is my chosen one and must be listened to. Rather than any human developments that we might have or Muhammad might have of religion and law, Jesus speaks clearly about who God is, about what it means to know him, about what will happen in the future, about how we can be saved forever and how we live now. And so Jesus is relevant now and forever. And he said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and the holy angels." Jesus is relevant today because as his followers we take up our cross, meaning we deny ourselves. We put to death ourselves to serve other people. That's of supreme relevance today. In a day of refugee crisis and benefit cuts, people are needy. We can serve them because we have to deny ourselves and follow Jesus. But more than that, he's relevant forever. Jesus says if we are not ashamed of him now, he won't be ashamed of us on the last day, when he appears in this dazzling glory that we have a picture of at the mountain here. It's interesting that this picture of a dazzling man in white is a dream that many Muslim people seem to be having across the Middle East and North Africa. It's in lots of literature at the moment, but this is happening. They're seeing this man in white who says, "Go and find out more about me. Meet Christian people. Read my book. Find out about me. And so that you might be forgiven." In many ways, this challenges us. Will we be ashamed of Jesus here and now in our workplaces? Will we be willing to talk about him, even if it does upset people? We don't try to upset or offend, but will we be unashamed of him? But also, it asks the question, will Jesus be ashamed of us? What will he think of us? Are we following him? Are we trusting him? Are we looking forward to the day when he returns and longing that others, from whatever background they are with us on that day as well? Thank you for listening. If you've got any questions, we're happy to chat about them afterwards, but do finish the rest of your meal and chat amongst yourselves. Thanks very much for coming.